Join me. You may be able to help solve a mystery.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome to another episode of You Solved a Mystery,
a podcast where we tell you about episodes of unsolved mysteries that are no longer unsolved or mysteries.
I'm Athena.
I'm Chandra. And if we sound exactly the same, it's because we're twins. There's nothing that we can do about it.
Sometimes
when I listen, I can't tell if that was me saying something, and I was there.
Same!
But that's just the world that we live in, because we were born this way.
So today, we're covering Son of Sam, Part 2.2. So the game continues. That drinking game that I suggested. Corroborated? Corroboration? Anything like that? Substantiated? Unsubstantiated? Keep it going. You're gonna get toasty. To start off, I have to correct myself. In part one, I said that John Deal drove Christine Froon to the hospital. I was mistaking that with Rosemary. Rosemary drove Carl to the hospital after he was shot. John Deal actually got out of the car and frantically had to try to stop people in the street. And people just drove right past him. Finally, someone stopped and they drove him back to his car where Christine was. And then they went and found a phone to call the police. So I just want to make sure that I'm being as factual as possible.
Honestly, if somebody was trying to flag me down while I was driving and it was dark, I'd probably pretend I hadn't seen them.
It would definitely depend how frantic they were being. If someone's standing in the middle of the street, waving their arms, trying to get me to stop, like,
okay, you maybe stop, don't turn off the car, don't put it in park. Crack the window a bit to make it easier to hear, maybe.
Yeah.
But then don't trust anything they say because maybe they're trying to kill you.
I think if you look in the face of someone who's covered in their fiancé's blood and they're telling you that they need help, I feel like you'd probably get the energy off them.
Unfortunately, I've never been in this situation, so I don't really know who I would be.
Most fortunately. May we all never face that situation. So when I decided to cover Unsolved Mysteries segment on Son of Sam, I had no idea what Sons of Sam, A Descent into Darkness on Netflix was about. And so I had already started my research, and then I realized that it was all about Mori Terry's theory. And so I was like, well, I have to watch this. It was directed by Joshua Zeman, who directed Cropsey, and he was friends with Mori Terry. Terry had actually approached him about doing a documentary on his work, but Lehman declined. It wasn't until 6 years after Terry's death that he released Sons of Sam. It covers everything from unsolved mysteries, plus a little more that I think is worth talking about. So once again, we travel back to 1977. After a year of terror brought by the mysterious Son of Sam, David Berkowitz was finally captured. Mori Terry, with his suspicions about Berkowitz's story, looked for the cars in the phone book, and he found the name John Wheat Carr. He remembered the reference to John Wheaties in the second Son of Sam letter and thought, could this be related? We're off to a bad start, right at the beginning. In 2009, Wheat Carr explained on Facebook, so I know it's one of my iffier sources, but I really truly do believe this was Wheat Carr. She explained that her father had gotten her and John their own phone line so that their calls wouldn't go to their parents' answering service. It was listed, as per the use, in the phone book under both their names, John Wheat Carr. John's middle name was Charles.
I bet that they just thought their dad was swell for getting them their own phone line.
They're so cool at school.
That was really dorky.
That's fine. The fact that John's middle name was Charles has never stopped papers and pop culture entertainment blurbs from erroneously and negligently presenting his name as John Wheat Carr. You still see it everywhere.
So the fact that his middle name was Charles, does that come from Wheat Carr?
Yes. Or,
so there's no documentation anywhere else?
I can't find any. None of the family has, like, a find-a-grave or anything, and I assume it's because they're afraid people would come and just write horrible messages.
Yeah, they kind of wound up with the wrong kind of fame.
Yeah.
By no fault of their own.
Big time. So Terry extrapolated John Wheaties from this, and instead of accepting that he had the wrong information, he fabricated that John was called Wheaties after his sister. But the nickname was known to very few, which is very convenient. As we know, 9 days after the last Son of Sam attack, when Stacy Moskowitz and Robert Violante were shot, NYPD Detective James Justice called the Yonkers Police Department to ask about one David Berkowitz, who had received a parking citation in the area of the shooting and might have information. The dispatcher who answered told him she knew Berkowitz, and that he wasn't a witness. He was the killer. That dispatcher was Wheat Carr.
What?
The Carr family had been receiving threatening, bizarre letters about their dog, Harvey. They reported the letters to police, but the family wasn't too concerned until Harvey was shot. Then, their house was firebombed. That's when Yonkers PD started to take them seriously.
One of the many things that gave me pause was the fact that Sam Carr went to the police when his dog was shot. Mm-hmm. Do Satanists go to the police?
Probably, because Satanists aren't in satanic cults and they don't kill people and they don't sacrifice animals.
Do leaders of satanic cults go to the police?
No, because they don't exist. In the Sons of Sam docuseries, one person says that Sam Carr was abusive and would lock his boys in the attic as punishment. I could find no corroboration for that. It would fit the first letter when Son of Sam says Papa Sam locks him in the attic, but I truly believe that it's a rumor created by believers in the theory to retrofit information to suit the story.
With the lack of physical evidence in this theory, you could make up anything.
Yeah, and it happened so long ago. The people who would know, they're passing away. There just aren't a lot of people to talk to anymore. After Berkowitz was arrested and the story about Harvey came out, reporters were crowded at the Carr family's doorstep, badgering anyone who came in or out, and the family protected Sam. They told the reporters, "He's not here, he's not talking, go away." And 10 years later, Wheat still lived with her parents, and she cared for both of them until their deaths. Somewhat ironically, Terry wasn't the only one who noticed John Wheat and Wicker in the second letter. It wasn't lost on Wheat Carr, whose family was receiving their own disturbing letters, that a version of her and her brother's names and their street had shown up in a Son of Sam letter. It helped to inform the family's idea that their neighbor, David Berkowitz, might be much more dangerous than he seemed. But Terry was so compelled by his observations of Wicker Street, John Wheat, and the composite sketches that he wrote an article alleging the connection between the Carrs, Berkowitz, and the Son of Sam notes, and began shopping it out to newspapers. So let's talk about composites. Police sketches don't actually have a great track record for accuracy. In 2011, the Philadelphia Inquirer reported that hand-drawn composites by trained artists are accurate only 9% of the time. Computer-generated images are even worse, at 5%. The National Center for State Courts, an organization that works to improve justice systems globally, reports that eyewitness testimony is the predominant cause of wrongful convictions exonerated by DNA. Advocates of justice have called for reforms regarding how a witness attempts to ID a suspect. And the Innocence Project can confirm. Eyewitness misidentification is the leading factor in the 344 wrongful conviction cases they've helped overturn through DNA evidence. And composite sketches themselves were a factor in 30% of the cases. That doesn't mean that they weren't correct 70% of the time. Not every case has a composite sketch. Composites are based on memories, which, as you said last week, are fallible. And they can be manipulated by various factors, intentionally or not. We saw that with the children interrogated about satanic ritual abuse. Their memories were manipulated.
Either that, or they were straight up lying in order to try to get out of a bad situation.
That's true.
But that doesn't discount the point. The brain makes inferences fast, and we can't take in every single little detail mm-hmm. of our environment. What's happening in the periphery of my vision, like, I sit next to this shelf once a week, and I can't tell you everything that's on it.
Mm-hmm.
But if I tried to describe it to you based on what I know of you, I could make some pretty good guesses. There's definitely a skull up there,
too.
There's probably some camera supplies, mm-hmm. lenses, whatever. That's just me filling in based on my bias.
Yeah, in my reading, I found that one of the problems with composite sketches is that research has found that people don't see faces as different parts. They see it as a whole. So when they're supposed to sit down and say, what did the eyes look like? That's not how people view faces. You can't pick it out that way. So that's why the computer composites are actually worse, because you're given like a set, these noses, which of these noses does it look like? And it doesn't come out as a whole. So actually a hand-drawn sketch, an artist has the ability to create a face out of all these bits, so they'll actually be more correct.
2% more accurate.
4%.
Splitting hairs there.
Composites also rely on a person's ability to accurately convey in words what a particular face looked like, and then have someone else understand that well enough to draw it. The very act of creating a composite can contaminate a witness's memory so that they can no longer discern whether the sketch is a likeness of their memory or if their memory has become a likeness of the sketch.
That makes me think of this idea that I heard of quite a while ago and haven't actually looked further into, but somebody told me that every time you remember a memory,
mm-hmm.
you're remembering the last time you remembered that memory.
Yeah.
Not the actual event itself. And so every single time it changes a bit until what you currently absolutely believe to be the truth of what happened might be completely different.
Yeah.
This has happened to you and me.
When we're both sure that we're the one that something happened to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or sure that something happened to the other one. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, we should not talk about it.
So if we look at the sketches again, imagine. It's dark out. It's stressful. You're scared. It's mere seconds of visibility. It's hours or days after seeing the person. But some of these still have features in line with Berkowitz. Yet it's not that provocative for them to be so different. It's like Detective Joseph Basteri said in the segment, you get a 3-second look at someone and hours to days later you're trying to describe them. They're not always accurate. Basteri understood that, and it could explain why Cecilia's sketch, that last one, was so off. It was 3 whole days after seeing him. And we know that she saw him, because she saw him take that ticket off his car. We know that she saw the real Berkowitz, and yet that's what she described.
That is compelling. Far more compelling than anything that Maura Terry has tried to tell me.
Back in 77, at the time Terry was looking for a publisher, most newspapers were being as sensational as possible to sell. So the New York Post took Terry's story. The Post also had a source who was appropriating documents from Berkowitz inside the hospital while he was undergoing his initial competency evaluations. Sons of Sam put it as befriending Berkowitz. That is not accurate. Freelance journalist James Mittiger was offering recorded conversations, notes, and photos smuggled out of the hospital to whoever would pay. One of the notes taken said that there was a bigger plot, that there were other sons of Sam. This supported Terry's theory. So Mittiger and Terry started swapping information. The New York Post published the photos in an article titled Sam Sleeps, and immediately found themselves in hot water. The photos weren't authorized or ethical, so authorities wanted to know how they got out, and the Post would be in legal trouble if it was found that they had exchanged money for them. Terry had hoped to speak to Berkowitz, but in response to the leak, all access was cut off. Not to be dismayed, Terry took the investigation to DA Eugene Gold to get the case reopened. The DA's office didn't agree that the story was compelling. So what Terry took from this meeting was that, quote, the powers that be weren't interested in uncovering the truth, but covering their asses. End quote. He thought it was a police cover-up because they didn't do a sufficient job catching the multiple killers.
I just feel like my chest is gonna implode.
Frustration.
Which logical fallacy is this?
I know. We were just looking at logical fallacies and I was like, oh my gosh, so many of these apply. There's an ad hoc, there's correlation fallacy. Jumping to conclusions is a fallacy.
I think you could definitely say that Terry's presenting a circular argument, but also it's a lot like the Texas sharpshooter fallacy, where a Texan, of course, shoots a bullet at the side of a barn and then paints a target around the spot where the bullet hit.
Yes, that's spot on. That's exactly what's happening. So during the Son of Sam investigation, the NYPD was criticized for not being transparent with the community, which is big fare. Hell yes to transparency and accountability from police. And the public was terrified. They wanted answers. They wanted justice. They wanted an arrest. But during the summer of Sam, murder was a commodity. It sold.
Capitalism's gonna capitalize.
So in a hectic and unprecedented situation of unpredictable serial violence, the NYPD detectives were trying to keep vital clues quiet, and they were trying to avoid hoaxes and copycats, and keep something that they could use to confirm that they did have their killer when they finally caught him. Chief of Detectives Joseph Borelli, who the first Son of Sam letter was addressed to, was the one who had to go to the crime scenes and see the blood and bodies of young people and the devastation of their families. He was a hardened detective, but in the ID documentary Son of Sam, The Hunt for a Killer, he admits it was getting to him. The NYPD knew that they had to catch this person in order to stop more young people from being killed. Lives literally counted on it. Covering it up wouldn't achieve that. It had to be solved. Police investigated close to 4,000 suspects, vigorously trailing some of them for weeks. Not only was it their job, it was emotional in a profession that is prejudiced against emotion. And when they finally caught Berkowitz, he had all the details about the shootings. He knew the days, the victims, where they were, how they were sitting, what they were doing, how they were shot, how many bullets were fired. As Jimmy Breslin, the reporter who got the second letter, said, quote, when they talked to David Berkowitz that night, he recalled everything step by step. The guy had 1,000% recall, and that's it. He's the guy, and there's nothing else to look at. End quote. And the shooting spree ended after his arrest.
I feel like that right there is decent evidence. And then if all it takes to get a satanic cult to stop randomly shooting people is for one person to take the fall, that's kind of weak sauce.
Psychiatrist Scott Bond, who I mentioned in part one, he's a criminologist and psychologist, and he met with Berkowitz in 2013. And he agrees. He says it's extremely rare for a serial killer like Berkowitz to work with others because they don't want to share whatever they're getting out of it with someone else. And Berkowitz told Bonn that the murders were solely his acts and no one else's. But like so many conspiracies, if you dig enough and you gather enough info, if you're like Dorothy Allison and you throw out 50 clues to see what sticks, you can find something that looks like a puzzle coming together, but the pieces have been forced.
I forgot about the profiler who basically was like, Berkowitz does not play well with others. How could he be part of an organized cult when he can't share his toys?
Untermeyer Park in Yonkers, New York, has a trail called the Old Croton Aqueduct. As the name implies, it's an old aqueduct, also known to some pygmy owls named Hunch as the Adequate Pipe. Annihilation. Aggravation. Untermeyer Park was donated to the city when owner Samuel Untermeyer died in 1940. It fell to ruins a bit because the upkeep was more than the city could actually handle, but now there's a conservancy working to restore it. It actually seems like a really cool place. It has an amphitheater surrounded by thousand-year-old Roman columns, fountains and pools, old structures being reclaimed by nature, and stairs that ascend to nothing.
I want to go to there.
I know. It also has an old, decrepit pump house, which is what the locals called the Devil's Cave. Terry went there after that boy contacted him and found it had bloodstains and satanic graffiti. I gotta say, anywhere there's graffiti, there's gonna be a pentagram. And also, pentagrams aren't always satanic. The pentagram is an ancient symbol, and it's used by many religions, including Wiccans, Mormonism, Judaism, and the occult. And its meaning varies from being a symbol for justice and mercy, to a way to bind demons, to protection from evil. And sometimes, when inverted, Baphomet's horns. But Terry thought the aqueduct might be the referent of the poetic "Hello from the Gutters" in the second letter. And because the park was only a mile from the car and former Berkowitz residences, he concluded this was where their satanic cult met. Terry began picking through the Son of Sam letters and found them riddled with the occult. In the first letter, there was the obvious Beelzebub, a prince of hell, lord of the flies. Terry found that brat is another word for an imp or small devil, and the Son of Sam's warning at the end, "I'll be back," was almost the exact same words Satan said in a fantasy novel called Black Easter. I think the Terminator's use was more iconic. As he dug into the occult, Terry found a 19th century talisman drawn by occultist Eliphas Levy that he felt resembled the symbol Berkowitz created. Yeah, that's the one you're looking at right now, Chandra.
I don't think so.
Sometimes called the Goetic Circle of Pacts, the symbol is meant to be used to summon a demon to make a deal. It has to be created with human skin and requires the skull of a parricide, someone who killed their parent, the horns of a goat, a male bat that has been drowned in blood, and a black cat that has fed on human flesh.
That is super specific.
But don't worry. The instructions include what to do to be sure you don't lose your soul in the pact. So I know you were worried about that, but it's okay. It's fine.
Oh, that's a huge relief.
Yeah. Four names are written around the sigil. Akabil, Azaradel, Berkael, and Amazarak. Berkael reminded Terry of Berkowitz.
Oh, there's that Texas shooter.
In a flash of genius, Terry remembered that occultists use mirrors in their rituals, and when held up to a mirror, he discovered Amazarak spelled backwards had Sam. And if you rearrange some letters, it had car. The way he put it was that it literally said Sam Car backwards, not that you had to rearrange it.
It would be more like Sam Car or Sam
Arakar. No. Sam Akara. There are too many A's.
Yeah, is my point.
That's not smooth. Even rearranging the letters, you still have excess letters. But hey, one of the other names, Azaradel, can be arranged to a rad seal. So maybe Levy just really liked sea puppies and thought they were really lit. Terry also connected that Sal and Judy had been at a nightclub called Eliphas the night they were shot, which is similar to the name of the occultist Eliphas. Eliphas, the nightclub, was named after the genus of the Asian elephant.
I'm into it.
And may I remind you that Donna and Jody were at peach trees? Try to make that satanic. So Terry decided to track down John Carr himself. But before he could speak with him, we know that John died by suicide in Minot, North Dakota. He was 31 years old, the oldest Carr child. Reporter Michael Zuckerman, who was with Terry in the beginning but kind of jumped ship as he got more obsessed, noted how it was convenient for Terry's theory, because now he could say John died because of cult involvement, and John would never be able to say otherwise.
Super convenient. Really tragic for Wheat.
Yeah.
She lost both of her brothers and then had to care for her ailing parents under this shroud of infamy.
Mm-hmm. There's actually no evidence that John and Berkowitz met. Sure, Berkowitz was harassing the family, clearly fixated on them. But John was stationed at Minot Air Force Base in 1974, 2 years before Berkowitz moved to 35 Pine Street. A friend of John's told Minot PD that she saw someone who looked like Berkowitz in a Minot bar while she and John were there one night, but denied that she or John knew him and said that they were not there together. And if you remember, the police found several journals in Berkowitz's apartment in which he had carefully cataloged his movements for years. He never recorded a trip to Minot, North Dakota. Minot PD heard from John's friends that he had mentioned a buddy named Berkey in New York, but I have a couple problems with this. One, like so much of the Minot quote-unquote evidence, it came from a secondhand source after John's death. Two, Berkey itself is a surname. He could have had a friend named George Berkey. In March of 1978, the Herald Statesman reported that the North Dakota police were still investigating John's death, but were 99% sure it was suicide and had no link to Son of Sam. Ward County Deputy Sheriff Glenn Geitzen told the Herald, quote, "Some yo-yo in the New York media said it was homicide, so we have to check out every angle," end quote.
Freaking yo-yos.
John suffered from depression. He had been divorced for several years. He had a young daughter who didn't live with him, and he was unemployed after leaving the Air Force. His roommates in Minot had had him committed to North Central Mental Health Hospital several times for treatment due to his depression. At the time of his death, he was in a love triangle with a married woman in Minot. He wanted her to leave her husband, but she wouldn't. John had returned to Yonkers 2 weeks before his death, seemingly giving up on the relationship, but he received a phone call from the woman he was in love with, and he drove back to Minot on February 14th. On February 16th, he died by suicide.
You just gave me a real big sad. I'm not trying to make light of it. I just know that a really, really big frown isn't going to translate over an audio media.
Are you ready for a big mad?
Okay, no more sad.
Terry wrote another article for the New York Post titled, "Son of Real Sam Kills Himself."
What a piece of shit.
Yeah, Real Sam, a real father who lost his child.
What an absolute human garbage can.
This was the kind of information where, as I started learning it, I just really couldn't abide anymore.
He is a shitty person.
Meanwhile, Mittiger, the freelancer who smuggled out all the stuff about Berkowitz from the hospital, was revealed as the leak and arrested. Terry decided that the arrest was retribution for trying to warn the public about John Carr and his dangerous satanic cult. And in my original notes from watching Sons of Sam, I just have in all caps, "What the fuck are you talking about?" Because here's the thing. Mittiger was arrested because he bribed a guard. He paid a guard at the hospital $5,800 to spy, record, take pictures, and steal paperwork, and he sold the photos to the New York Post for $20,000. He smuggled out contraband that added to Berkowitz's celebrity status and the media frenzy that was fetishizing murder for profit, as Screen Rant put it. And the Daily News reported that Mittiger had faked some of his information, presenting second- and third-hand gossip as first-hand fact. All of that was conveniently left out of Sons of Sam.
So many conveniences.
Such a great docuseries. Mittiger was caught when he tried to bribe another guard, who turned him in immediately.
Somebody's gotta have scruples.
A boon to Terry's investigation was that he really got Minot police on his side, especially Lieutenant Terry Gardiner, who was heavily featured in his book, The Ultimate Evil.
They just liked that they shared a name.
Terry learned from a mental health counselor in Minot named Lee Slater.
Wait, which Terry?
Maury Terry. And obviously there was not HIPAA at the time, because he told him that John had come to his clinic agitated and told him that he thought that someone was going to try to kill him, that he might be in trouble with the law, and that he had a connection to Berkowitz and info the police might be interested in. According to Sons of Sam, he said that he had been involved in witchcraft in Minot. And again, I'm going to say, witchcraft isn't inherently satanic.
This also sounds like a lot of hearsay.
Yes. There are times that I almost wonder if John was interested in sigils and rituals and the occult, because he was a Scientologist, and Scientology has roots in occultism. The problem is, when you try to search for more information about John Carr, his Minot associates, or satanic rituals in Minot, you're always brought back to the same source. Maury Terry. Good one. His articles, his book. Nobody can corroborate this. Take a drink. After Terry went to Minot and started asking around and posing his theories, the police, quote-unquote, learned that John led a satanic cult there and definitely killed a German shepherd and drank its blood. To my point, Lieutenant Gardner actually said on camera, quote, "We didn't find it ourselves, but we have documentation from other people who were present," end quote.
Where is it?
They have secondhand sources at best.
Terry Gardner, where's your documentation? Give it.
Yep. There's no evidence. Credit where credit is due, I have to say that I read excerpts of The Ultimate Evil, and the way Maury Terry presented his theory was actually very convincing. He's a good writer. The story's told from inside his investigation, so there's dialogue and scene setting, and it almost feels like film noir. The reader is with Terry as he's meeting with sheriff's deputies in the local bar, sitting around drinking, being tough guys. At one point, trigger warning for suicide. So John had used a gun to die, and Gardiner refers to John Carr as becoming oatmeal. And the feel of the book is, it's gross, but you're a tough guy and you can take it. So what I read, I hated. But I can see why people have been convinced by it. There were even times that I started questioning whether something was true, but I tried to fact check it, only to find it came back to Terry. No corroboration. Take a drink. Like Phil Falcon, who was mentioned in Unsolved Mysteries. You know, some point along the way, when I'd watched the segment and then I'd been doing a lot of research, in my mind, I created an actual interview with Phil Falcon. I was like, oh yeah, I gotta go back and watch that interview with Phil Falcon. He wasn't interviewed.
Hey, how about that faulty memory?
Yeah. So, Phil Falcon was said to have walked in on John and a friend, ritualistically sacrificing an animal in Phil Falcon's home. According to Terry's own book, Falcon was a friend of John's who was also interested in the occult. John had read all of his books about it. He ran a coffee shop called Falcon's Nest, which sounds super cute. And in Terry's book, it was said to be a meeting place for members of the occult, as in Satanists. If Phil Falcon was into the occult, maybe it was just an occult book group. Phil Falcon conveniently moved to the Pacific Northwest and never spoke of it again. Nor did any other supposed cult members that Terry mentioned in his book. Tragically, only 18 months after John's death, his brother, Michael Carr, died. He lost control of his car and ran into a highline pole at 90 miles per hour. Michael had apparently joined the Church of Scientology in an endeavor to get sober, but some sources say that he was drunk at the time. He was very involved in the church and had recently completed an executive delegation and supervision course in Florida at their headquarters. I don't know what that means, but obviously he was very involved with the church. So it was a horrible car accident. Someone in Sons of Sam actually says that Michael's death had to be related to the cult because people don't just accidentally lose control of their car and crash.
Oh my god, but they do.
Sir, you are an adult. You know better than this.
Apparently not.
And then from my original notes on the show, now Charles Manson is here. Great. An occult historian named Gary Lockman was interviewed in Sons of Sam, and he was one of my favorites because he had a lot of interesting info. And he shone some light on why German shepherds were significant. If you remember, it was German shepherds that were supposedly found in Untermeyer Park. And it was a German shepherd that John supposedly killed and drank the blood of.
I do remember because I'm very concerned for German shepherds in New York.
Well, you don't need to be. John and Michael Carr were both Scientologists. Back before their time, in 1963, a group had branched off of Scientology to form the Process Church of the Final Judgment. Its founders, Marianne and Robert Grimston, either left the church or were kicked out, but Gary said that they were looking for something more extreme. The Process Church borrowed from Scientology, practiced occult rituals, and leaned culty. For example, they came to America, bought an old bus, and moved 30 members, along with all their German shepherds, to Mexico, where the Grimstons ruled as the Omega.
That sounds awfully culty.
But German shepherds were a symbol for this occult church that branched from Scientology. They revered them. Then in Mexico, a hurricane tore through their camp, and many left. They went back to London, where, hang on, they opened a library in an all-night coffee shop called Satan's Cavern. Can I go there, please? I want to do all my research, all my homework, all my things at the all-night coffee shop called Satan's Cavern.
I gotta say, that was a twist.
There's gonna be another twist. You're gonna love it. During the hurricane in Mexico, Robert Grimston said that he saw visions of an apocalyptic event.
Was it the hurricane?
I know. Look out the window. I would see one too. But he said he received the message that he had to combine good and evil, wipe out the bourgeois, and bring on the end of the world. The Process Church recognized four gods, who were not literal deities, but characteristics of every person. So in the Process Church, Jehovah was strength, Lucifer was light, Satan was separation, and Christ was unification. None of them were evil. They didn't practice magic, and they were not Satanists. But this is why Manson came up in the docuseries. He lived near the San Francisco branch of the church, so prosecutors during the trial alleged that he had learned about Satanism from the Process Church, and that it influenced his idea of Helter Skelter, which the church denied, and there's no proof that the church was involved with Manson at all, but it still hurt their reputation because people believed it. It's so classic, people being like, oh, this weird person lives near these other weird people that I don't understand, and therefore they must be in cahoots.
Would that be the cause and effect fallacy?
Sounds right. Or the or the correlation fallacy.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's right.
But I say no. Settle down. Just because you don't understand two different things, it doesn't mean they're the same. A bee is not a yellow jacket. The Process Church eventually disbanded and the Grimstons split up. Most members remained loyal to Marianne, and in 1991, after all their efforts to remain a cult had failed, they opened an animal sanctuary.
Okay.
Called Best Friends Animal Society.
Okay.
In addition to their own 3,700 acres in Utah, they lease 33,000 more from the government, and they house over 1,500 animals, including domesticated animals and wildlife that can't be released. They do shelter outreach, they advocate for no-kill rescue, they promote adoption and spay and neuter programs, they help with TNR programs, they've helped with rescue after natural disasters, and in 2007, and I don't know why this makes me cry, but they took 22 of the 47 dogs seized from Michael Vick's dogfighting ring, who were expected to be euthanized for aggression, and rehabilitated them. When I first read that, it made me cry.
It wasn't just the first time you read it. I don't know how we got from point A to point B, but I love point B.
Yeah, what does the Process Church have to do with our story? Almost nothing. Because John and Michael were Scientologists, they weren't members of the Process Church. But I thought it was interesting because their care for animals is so antithetical to animal sacrifices. So it seemed worth pointing out. But enough religious studies and feel-good animal rescues.
No, you can never have enough feel-good animal rescues.
Maury Terry thought the tragic deaths of the Carr brothers were proof of his theory, with their deaths being orchestrated by the 22 disciples as part of a cover-up.
Can we stop talking about him yet?
That's what the whole segment is about.
That reminded me of the day that you were doing some research and you just messaged me. I literally just slammed my fist on the table. I'm so sick of Maury Terry.
Yep.
I've been that way for a little while now.
Because of Maury Terry's articles, Mike Loria and Jerry and Nisa Moskowitz came to believe that there was a cult and that the people who had killed their children were still out there. They were scared again. And they lost the mild comfort of feeling that they had received justice for their children. After 2 years of investigating, as Terry's theory reached more and more people, D.A. Santucci called a press conference to address the Son of Sam case. Terry thought he was about to be arrested like Mittiger as revenge for trying to expose the truth. And again, Mittiger did something illegal. He bribed a frickin' guard. And then from my original notes, I have, Terry's a drama queen. To Terry's delight, Santucci announced that he believed Berkowitz didn't act alone. The Queen's DA office began investigating, which is unusual. It's not usually the DA's office place to investigate. Joseph Borelli thought it was all bullshit. He thought Santucci needed a boost of publicity as an election was coming up. But Terry received another gold mine. After hearing about his theory, Berkowitz wrote to him and said he was in a cult, and John Carr was part of it. Berkowitz also sent Lieutenant Gardner and Minot a book called The Anatomy of Witchcraft, with notes written in the margins. He had been sending Gardner a lot of letters about the occult, so much that Gardner told a local newspaper, quote, "It appears that he's challenging me to become a 20th century witch hunter," end quote. One note in the book said, quote, "Arliss Perry, hunted, stalked, and slain, followed to California, Stanford University," end quote. Arliss Perry was a 19-year-old newlywed who moved from North Dakota to California so her husband could attend Stanford. On October 12, 1974, Arliss was brutally murdered in a campus church. She was found posed, naked from the waist down. And the details are more disturbing than I care to repeat. Investigators assumed that the murder was satanic because candles from the church's altar were used in the posing. Police from Santa Clara went to Attica to speak with Berkowitz, and he strung them along for a while before saying he couldn't say any more or they'd think he was a snitch and kill his father. They asked him if there was any truth to the info that Terry gave them, and Berkowitz said he'd never communicated with Maury Terry before. Feelings hurt, Maury Terry tried to visit Berkowitz at the prison, but he wouldn't see him. He wrote him again, this time recanting the story about the cult. He wouldn't cooperate with the Santucci investigation either. Things are about to go off the rails, so bear with me while I speed through this. A prison informant dubbed Vinny wrote to Zuckerman, the journalist I mentioned earlier who was working with Terry at first, that Berkowitz told him all about the cult and that Stacy Moskowitz's murder had been filmed to make a snuff film that would be sold to the highest bidder. Zuckerman rejected the information because prison informants aren't reliable. Guess what Terry did? He ran with it. According to Vinny, a photographer named Ron Sisman operated the camera. Ron was a playboy who always had cocaine and was known to quote-unquote film girls in his apartment. What does that mean? I don't know. Maybe it was porn. In 1981, on Halloween night, he and his girlfriend Elizabeth Platzman were murdered, and his apartment was ransacked. The murder was never solved. According to Vinny, Ron was a member of the Process Church of the Final Judgment, and he was killed by the Untermeyer cult for the snuff film because they wanted to use it to cause chaos. So where's the film? Not that I want to see it.
No, I never want to see a snuff film, but the fact that it doesn't exist is kind of telling.
Mm-hmm. But Ron had a van, and there was a van parked near where Stacy and Robert were shot.
And there's only one van in the world.
That's exactly what I have in my notes. Oh, you got me. There's only one van in the world. Case closed. Vinny's letter said Ron was associated with someone in Southampton called R.R., who liked odd films. Terry realized showbiz promoter Roy Raden lived in Southampton. Roy Raden was a rich guy with a huge mansion where he had orgies and cocaine parties. In 1980, Raden and two others assaulted and raped an actress after she refused to participate in an orgy, and they filmed it. So just to be clear, these guys are total scumbags.
Scumbags puts it lightly.
Yeah. In 1983, Roy Raden was murdered and dumped into Canyon. So, yay! Terry thought someone was intentionally taking out each of his leads one step ahead of him. He went to LA and searched the area where the body was found. Near the site where the body was dumped, Terry found a Bible. The cover was decrepit. To me, someone lost a Bible and it sat in the LA wilderness for however long. But to Terry, finding a Bible near the body was a sign of satanic involvement. In 1988, four people were arrested for the murder. Terry was real disappointed to find out that it was a contract killing over a failed movie. He believed all of the above was involved with the cult, based on the word of the informant and some leaping conclusions. It's all confirmation bias.
A failed movie is a really bad reason to put a contract hit on somebody.
Yeah, apparently some people had lost millions.
So you spend more money to have somebody killed? How is that going to help you?
Rich people, man. I don't know. In 1987, Maury Terry published The Ultimate Evil. It was very successful. Borelli hated it, saying that it was based on hearsay and conspiracy theories.
Sounds about right.
Borelli, bless him, sweet voice of reason, pointed out that people's stories started changing after the book was published. According to a news clip, it was speculated at the time that there were 2,000 satanic cults in America and 2 million people involved. We already know from Special Agent Lanning that that's not accurate. Our friend occult historian Gary said that Satanism was a scapegoat for other anxieties. I think Lanning would agree. Terry thought that satanic panic was overshadowing his case. In 1993, an NYPD detective who would visit Berkowitz in prison to discuss religion reached out to Terry because he thought his book was interesting. He invited him to visit Berkowitz with him. Terry decided to do one better and get a televised interview. On September 23, 1993, Terry interviewed him. It was the first time Berkowitz ever spoke publicly. He told Terry that he felt like everything that happened was destiny. He didn't have a choice. There was a force pulling him to act. The problem with the interview was that Terry was leading, asking things like, "Is it true that?" rather than open-ended questions. Kind of like the overzealous interviews of the children. So Berkowitz repeated Terry's story back to him. He said he was lonely after leaving the military and went to a party where he met people who invited him to little religious services in Untermeyer Park. Then they started doing animal sacrifices, and things escalated quickly, and he made a blood pact to serve the devil, and the others told him that if he betrayed them, they'd kill his family. He said the Son of Sam murders were planned by the cult as the ultimate sacrifice, and John and Michael Carr were also shooters. But he wouldn't name anyone else. At one point in the interview, Terry stated, "The evidence I uncovered shows that John Carr shot Donna and Joanne." And Berkowitz responded, quote, "If I believe correctly, yes," end quote. Not if I remember correctly. If I believe correctly. He was at all the shootings. He recalled all the details. But he doesn't remember if the shooter was John. Sounds sus. And I know what you're trying to ask, Chandra. I know what's in your mind. You're asking, why would he lie? Maybe it's because he's delusional. Maybe it's because he's suggestible. And possibly because he has a vendetta against the Carrs. Carl DeNaro watched the interview on Inside Edition, and he was stunned to hear Berkowitz say on TV that he's not the one who shot him. He started looking into getting the case reopened, because he wanted justice, which is totally fair. But he wound up meeting Terry and joining his investigation. Terry would send him leads to track down, and he became part of Terry's inner circle. Which is starting to sound kind of culty, if you ask me. With no other progress in his investigation, Terry arranged a new televised interview with Berkowitz in 1997 to be aired as a limited series. In a recording you can hear before the interview has actually started, you hear Berkowitz ask how long the series is going to be. He's totally trying to gauge how famous he's going to be. For the second interview, Terry got help from an investigative reporter for WNBC named Sarah Wallace, who initially thought his story was compelling, but as the interview progressed, she became less sure. She realized Terry had his own agenda. He was being overly aggressive, again asking leading questions, and ultimately he hurt his credibility. And the interview was the same as the first one. Berkowitz was literally confirming what Terry said and not offering anything new. He was giving yes and no answers in an interview. He again refused to give any names other than John and Michael Carr, even though other supposed cult members had died by then. Sarah didn't buy it. She felt Berkowitz was lying. Another journalist who helped Terry with both interviews, Wayne Darwin, felt that Berkowitz wasn't saying anything of value and was just telling Terry what he wanted to hear. Terry wanted to finally get the truth, but there was no truth to get. Berkowitz couldn't give him names because there weren't any to give. Sarah Wallace believed Terry was too obsessed, and she said, quote, "People who are obsessed with cases don't want to see reality. And sometimes the truth smacks you in the face and you have to say, it wasn't what I thought and I need to back off," end quote. But Terry couldn't do that. In 1998, Yonkers detective Kevin Murphy, a friend of Terry's, wrote up a final report on cult activity in Untermeyer Park. He said a group of people who called themselves the Children used to hang out at the park doing drugs and getting nasty. And as a friend of Terry's, he wanted to find out if they were the fabled Untermeyer Park cult Berkowitz, John, and Michael were in. But it was inconclusive because no one who had been a part of the group would talk to him. He did find one man named John Paul, who said that when they were teenagers, John Carr had invited him to druid rituals in the park. And though they were benign at first, more like games than actual rituals, one day there were 40 or 50 people doing a ritual and he could hear dogs getting killed. I don't think Kevin Murphy found John Paul's information to be credible. Kevin said it was difficult to separate fact and fiction throughout the investigation. And I hear you, Kevin. I hear you. I think Kevin is a man of reason, someone who can step back and say, okay, the information led me somewhere and now I will accept it. He said, quote, evil people do evil things. It has nothing to do with some satanic force. End quote. Terry started declining. He had spent 2 decades researching the case, trying to find the proof that would make his theory stick, led by his own confirmation bias. He started to believe that there were secret messages in the letters Berkowitz sent him and in his interview. He started seeing cults everywhere. He told Kevin that the security guard who found Arliss Perry's body in the church was the murderer and must be involved with the cult, but he couldn't say why he thought that, because he didn't actually have any evidence. Sons of Sam tried to make it a big deal that DNA proved, in 2018, that it was the security guard, Stephen Crawford, who killed Arliss. Crawford died by suicide when police arrived at his apartment to arrest him. But he wasn't in a cult. It was a crime of opportunity, and he was a foul motherfucker. And Terry had been an investigative reporter, so maybe there was some old spark of instinct, but he couldn't separate it from his obsession. Zuckerman felt that Terry started to confuse conclusions and theories, making erroneous connections. His friends stopped following along with everything he said. As Carl DeNaro put it, he was all over the place, and if you didn't agree with him, you were dead to him. Carl said that one day, he said to Terry, "Maury, this isn't your case." Terry responded, "Yes, it is my case." Carl said, "It's my case just as much," to which Terry responded, "What did you do?" Carl said, "I got shot in the head." Snap. Terry became an alcoholic. Someone had described him as a drinker but not a drunk. And as soon as I heard that, I was like, oh, I know where this is going. In his obsession, he had thrown himself into a story filled with darkness. His ex-wife, Georgiana, ran into him in 2010 and didn't even recognize him because he had lost so much weight. Stress had taken such a toll on him. And she said, quote, "He thought he was doing okay. He really was delusional," end quote. In 2015, Maury Terry passed away from heart failure. On his deathbed, mere hours before his passing, he asked Kevin Murphy to re-examine old leads. Sons of Sam presents Maury Terry as David Berkowitz's final victim, a man driven over the edge by obsession. But what about the cars? Shortly after Berkowitz's arrest, Sam Carr attended a Kiwanis Club luncheon. It's an organization that helps children around the world. And the leader stood and announced that the real Son of Sam in the Son of Sam case was among them. The audience laughed and applauded, but Sam just tried to hide behind his napkin, thoroughly embarrassed. The first time Michael Carr ventured out, he went to a bar where he had been a regular and was introduced as the real Son of Sam. He too was embarrassed. Wheat Carr was pestered by rumors that she had dated Berkowitz. Not only had they been the subject of threatening, bizarre, and frightening letters and violence from Berkowitz, they were now being hounded at home by reporters, receiving aggressive, abusive, angry calls at the answering service, and getting letters from a public who thought that Sam Carr had literally ordered David Berkowitz to kill and should be locked up as well. It was so bad that they hired a lawyer and instructed him to ask for a $15,000 to $20,000 fee for interviews to discourage the press. There were accusations that they were trying to profit, but they rejected bids for storybook or film rights and balked at the idea of bringing Harvey on talk shows or selling shirts with his image, considering such proposals in poor taste. They didn't think it was right to profit from this nightmare, though they did feel entitled to some of the reward money. They finally decided to speak with the New York Times in 1979, at no fee, to try to clear up some misinformation. They had received over 100 letters accusing them of being willing accomplices. They also received letters from Berkowitz while he was in the hospital. They were angry and frightened to actually receive a letter from their tormentor, now a known serial killer. The first one was written from the psychiatric hospital in September of 1977, so just 1 month after he was arrested. And it referred to Sam as "My Lord" and "Papa God," and said that Sam should be the one in prison and that he'd expose him as the one who made him kill and destroy the family.
Speculating, do you think that he genuinely believed this or it was some sort of ploy?
I think that he really thought that there were demons commanding him to do things. So if he really believed that it was Sam Carr controlling the demons, then he might have really believed it at the time.
I know that he thought that Harvey was possessed by Samhain.
Samhain, huh?
Sometimes pronounced as Samhain.
Well, that makes sense. That even works with the whole Son of Sam thing, because it's spelled with Sam.
Yep. At least that's what he claims.
Mm-hmm. Wheat Carr told Investigation Discovery, in the very first time in decades she'd spoken about the case, that Maury Terry and her brother John went to school together, and that Terry targeted John to get back at him for some childhood slight. Terry claimed in his book to not remember John until a family member reminded him. The accusations against John and Michael hurt Wheat, who ultimately lost her entire family, beyond words. The family has been the target of harassment ever since the arrest. And initially, I had written that the family had been the target of harassment ever since the arrest, but continues to go on for Wheat. The people who insist on linking John and Michael's deaths to the case have added to the family's grief for years, for decades. They tried to take legal measures to stop the accusations against John and Michael, and it ate away at Sam that they couldn't do anything. You can't bring charges of libel against someone if the person they're slandering is dead, because the legal system doesn't consider there to be any harm or injury done to the dead person.
Oy.
What about the family that tragically lost two sons and brothers, just over a year apart? Sam's last words to his daughter were, "Take care of your mother and clear your brother's names." There was no evidence that any of the Carrs were involved with the Son of Sam murders. Wheat even said that Yonkers PD had time-stamped cards showing that Michael was working at the answering service on the night of some killings, and that the Air Force had sent John out of the country during some of them. These I take with a grain of salt because I haven't seen this documentation, and I find it a little odd that something so damning to Terry's accusations wouldn't be released. And like I've been saying all along, corroboration. I'm not a one-way street. But please, please somebody release those documents. Please. So because Wheat had worked with the police as a dispatcher, she had reported the strange letters and shown them to the officer she worked with. Though they initially didn't take them too seriously, after Harvey was shot, the Carrs started pushing the police to investigate. Then the house was firebombed, and I imagine that was the Molotov cocktail that thankfully didn't hurt Harvey. And then they were contacted by the Cassaras, the family that Berkowitz had briefly lived with in 1975 until their German Shepherd's barking drove him to leave. It was the first time he heard demons coming from a dog.
Is that what they were contacting them about?
Well, the Cassaras were contacting the Carrs because they had also received a letter. It was a bizarre get-well card for Jack Cassara that had been signed Sam and Francis Carr. And after it arrived, Nan Cassara contacted the Carrs because no one in the house was sick.
That's creepy.
Right? It's the most subtle threat. I hope you're well. I'm not sick! When compared, it was clear from the handwriting that the writers were the same. After hearing about Harvey being the subject of so many letters, the Cassara's son remembered their tenant who had had an issue with dogs. With all these bizarre letters, in the media and in their mailboxes, with Wicker, John Wheaties, the hatred of dogs, and the attacks against them, Wheat was sure that Berkowitz was the Son of Sam. By June of 1977, the Carrs were trying to tell the police to look into Berkowitz. And they had Yonkers PD on their side. The officer assigned to their case told ID that he tried to call the task force over and over but could never get through. The Carrs believed that had the police taken them more seriously from the beginning, Stacy Moskowitz might still be alive. If they were in a cult together, why? Why would they be trying so hard to turn Berkowitz in? Maury Terry willfully ignored the car's reality in a way that caused them undue grief, and it was heartless. Those of us who are interested in true crime should never forget the humanity of the people we talk about, you know?
Mm-hmm. Except for John Burns and Robert Weeks.
Police contacted the Casaras after the arrest because Jack was also mentioned in one of the letters Craig Glassman received. Craig Glassman was the deputy who lived in the apartment right below Berkowitz, who was also the target of letters. You remember Die, Craig, Die?
Mm-hmm.
And he had had that explosive fire set in a bucket outside his apartment door. According to Nan, the letter said something like, quote, "I know the Casara and Carr are out to get me, and they put you here," end quote. The Investigation Discovery documentary had more pictures from Berkowitz's apartment of the supposedly satanic writing, and I gave them to you there. So one says, "Sam Carr, my master," with an X underneath, kind of like the X in his sigil. Another says, "22 Wicker Street says kill. The beasts of 22 Wicker need blood. Innocent people must die," says 22 Wicker. 22 Wicker Street, the house of hate, the house of murder, the house of death, end quote. But the last one is the one that I find the most interesting. It says, "Glassman worships the devil and has power over me," again with an X underneath. Between the crude, threatening letters, the fiery attack on his apartment, and the accusation that he had control over him, I think Berkowitz's level of obsession with Craig Glassman was relatively equal to his obsession with the cars. So why didn't Terry accuse Craig, or the Casaras for that matter, of being part of the cult? I think it's because they were alive to defend themselves. In 1990, Yonkers PD reopened the Son of Sam investigation, and though it's still an open case, it was suspended due to lack of findings. I'm happy to say that in a letter to her during the time they were corresponding, Berkowitz apologized to Nisa Moskowitz for murdering Stacy, so Nisa did die believing that justice was served. His written word was the proof she needed. This has been so long I can't really get into it, but it's so important. Satanic Panic lives on today under a new name, QAnon. It's an unsubstantiated moral panic. Instead of preschools and daycares, QAnon followers believe Democrats are kidnapping children to use their blood in satanic rituals. And the Save the Children hashtag they created that pulls well-meaning parents into their clutches has made it harder for advocates who fight sex trafficking to do their work.
This is one of those things that hurts me. It's so wild.
The far right doesn't like Democrats. And like Special Agent Lanning said, it's easier to deal with perceived harm if you make the perceived harmer completely evil. You remember Pizzagate?
Yeah.
So it predates QAnon by a couple years, but definitely correlates and helped lead up. Pizzagate was the conspiracy that Hillary Clinton and other Democrats were holding children in the basement of a pizza parlor. The McMartin preschool didn't have a labyrinth of tunnels underneath, and that pizza parlor didn't have a basement. During his investigation, Special Agent Kenneth Lanning had to ask, if satanic cults weren't real, why did so many thinking, well-educated professionals believe it was? He resolved that, regardless of intelligence and education, and often despite common sense and evidence to the contrary, adults tend to believe what they want to believe. The moral hysteria of satanic panic led rational adults to buy in, and that's the same thing we're seeing with QAnon. Families are being torn apart, and instead of vigilante parents digging under a school, thousands of armed insurrectionists storm the Capitol and threaten the lives of the politicians who could do nothing but hide. Mary DeYoung, a sociologist who studied moral panics, told NPR that the best weapon against baseless moral panic is to push the facts, because the conspiracies and wild theories that lead to social hysteria will collapse under the weight of them. She said, quote, "They just get ridiculous. Except for maybe a very small number of true believers who can tolerate an enormous amount of dissonance." End quote. As Special Agent Lanning said, "We have to think critically and search for truth in fantastical stories, because if we don't, we risk justice being overshadowed by fantasy." David Berkowitz is 68 years old and incarcerated at Shawangunk Correctional Facility in New York. In 2017, he had a heart attack, and he's had two surgeries to repair the damage. As of 2016, he says that at the time of the murders, he was delusional and unaware. He says he is remorseful.
So I watched some of an interview with him. It was long. It was multiple parts on YouTube, and I couldn't handle it. But from what I saw, he is a very good storyteller. If he hadn't gone down the serial killer route, he'd be real popular in, like, the corner bar or whatever, telling stories. And he can make himself come across as humble while sliding in excuses for his behavior. Like, he described this false guilt that he had lived with because he thought that he had killed his mom in childbirth. He slipped in there that he had used LSD, not to make excuses, and was under hypnotic control, not to make excuses.
What? By who?
He also talked about fetuses being affected by trauma that happened in their environment, even in the womb. And while there may be basis for that, a lot of fetuses experience trauma and don't decide to murder people.
I'm still hung up on the hypnotic control thing.
It was related to the LSD.
If you're saying you're under hypnotic control, then you're rejecting accountability.
Yeah, but he said it was not to make excuses.
Okay, got it.
He claimed that rejection and confusion and having misinformation around his biological parents had, quote, opened the door to the entry of demonic control in his life.
So he did learn something from that psychologist who tried to blame his mothers.
He was so obviously willing to participate in this interview, this opportunity to just talk about his life. He talks about his mom with a smile and his dad keeping his birth certificate and comes across as just some normal guy. Oh, well, refusing to speak about the Son of Sam incidents and also clinging to the infamy that it brought him. These interviews wouldn't be happening if he hadn't been the Son of Sam. Mm. And so it kind of made me wonder if the best justice for David Berkowitz would be to allow him to be forgotten to time as we record an episode.
Yeah.
Of a podcast about David Berkowitz.
Right.
Before our parents died, they expressed that maybe heaven is how people remember you. So hell is being forgotten.
If heaven is how people remember you, then let's just say again that David Berkowitz murdered 6 young people, wounded 7 others, and brought devastation to families. And let's not forget it. So, did David Berkowitz conspire with others to commit his terrible acts? Probably not. Was he in a satanic cult? No. It's fine to believe in some things that don't have physical or substantiated proof, but we should ask ourselves if that belief is causing harm in the world. As the Satanic Temple says, undue suffering is bad. Reducing suffering is good. Hail Satan. Thank you so much for sticking with us during this wild dive into the Son of Sam. It's been real intense for me doing a full month of research on on one case, and thank you, Chandra, for sticking it out with me.
Athena really did just sink into a universe of murder and accused Satanism and the douchebag that is Maura Tarry.
But it was, I wouldn't say fun, but really interesting to do such a deep dive into one case. I basically have a 60-page paper on the Son of Sam now, so if I ever do apply to grad school, maybe I'll submit that as a writing sample.
Hey, you're going for psychology. It works.
I'll have the pictures that we talked about on our Instagram. It's YouSolvedAMystery. You can email us at YouSolvedAMystery@gmail.com.
You can also give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts.
Oh, here. If you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, I will try to make it into a poem.
I like this.
Yeah.
I might have to find a way to download Apple Podcasts so that I can leave a review.
You'll get a shout out on our next episode.
I want a poem.
And lastly, maybe share us with a friend.
Or two.
And as always, I'm Athena.
And I'm Chandra.
Join us next time for You Solved a Mystery.